afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio, another episode.
another fun-filled afternoon.
We're always having some sort of episode, but you know what? Today, I don't see any foul-ups except for the fact that the chat room appears to not be working. There's always something, you know. Our guest is on a landline.
Okay, not be working is, for those who don't know, it's a brand new website with a completely different chat room format, shall we say, and it's still a work in progress.
It's so, going to be better, just not right now.
Let us know what you think.
But you can't tell us.
But don't tell us what you think right now.
Based upon the response so far this morning, I can almost guarantee you it will get better.
Yeah, because I have a big white page. Not helpful. So it's a good thing our guest knows what she's talking about, and we're not going to rely on the input from others, although we would like your input. We just can't get it from here. If you do need to send us a note or a message, you can always use my cell phone. You can always text me. Don't call me. People do that during the radio. It's like I can't actually talk to both of you at once. But you could text me at 530-515-7135. So we could go old school with that technology.
Yes.
It's funny that old school is texting, huh?
You are living on the edge giving out your phone number on the radio.
I always give out my phone number. What the heck, you know? You should be easy to find. I've always been easy to find.
Yeah, but don't be surprised because it doesn't always work for me.
Yeah, don't text Bill. He never knows.
No.
I come home, I'm like, did you get my message? No.
I'm saying when I call you, I never get you, so
That's because you have a special ringer that says, can't wait till later.
Yeah, okay.
It's special music, can't wait till later.
We'll talk later.
It's a song. It's a little song I know.
Yeah.
I guess you already know. You know my phone number, but my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
So there you can identify the voices. And our guest today is Elaine Willman. And she is joining us from Montana.
Are we gonna thank our sponsors?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. We have
got all higgledy-piggledy here at the beginning.
We have sponsors.
Do it.
Okay. Powerhouse Solar. We want to thank them for sponsoring the show this hour. They take care of all your solar needs here in Reading in the North State, and give them a call.
And they've been doing it a long time, too.
Yes, they have.
They're not like the fly-by-night solar guys.
No, give Bruce and Sue a call over there, and they can fix you up with just about anything you want. Their phone number is 530-275-5600.
Yeah, you were going there.
Yeah, I was going there. I was going to have you fax them, but don't fax them. Call them.
Yeah, don't fax them.
They like to talk to you.
And their website is powerhousesolar.com.
.com.
Ta-da! And thanks to all the individuals who sponsor the show. And I don't know if they request we keep their names private because they don't want to be associated with us publicly. or they just want to kind of keep sure, we, you know, make sure we don't disappear in the night.
That's right. We know who you are.
Yeah, we do. And thanks a lot. We appreciate
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
All right. Have we done all our chores?
I think so.
Bob, we forget anything?
Nope. Elaine is standing by.
Nice. All right, Ms. Willman, you sent me an email. You want to give folks a little snippet about you? I have posted all that on the website, but it's more fun when you do it.
Well, hello to you guys. I'm just thinking about all of you there floating away in California. And
yeah,
hoping,
but you know, don't get too excited because it's still a drought. You know, Jerry made sure to let us all know we're still having a drought.
Still having a drought.
Yeah, right.
You're in for another soaking, I guess, you know. I'm sitting here up in the beautiful Moise Valley of the Flathead Indian Reservation. It's just absolutely gorgeous, bright, sunny day. And but I wanted to take an opportunity, and thank you for that, to talk about a couple of national policies on the radar. One's moving right now, and the other one's starting up. The one that's moving right now is an effort to give our National Bison Range, which is, you know, an American treasure, absolutely gifted back to a little tribe, the Salish Kootenai tribe here. And there's a problem with that, not just the National Bison Range, but the National Bison Range is on the chopping block as we speak. But back in 2002, the Department of Interior listed 90 national parks, wildlife refuges, and the public resources, you know, public treasures, listed them as available to be managed and taken over by private tribal governments. The problem with that, and we could be talking Irish tribal governments, this isn't about culture, this is about separate private governments that do not follow the U.S. Constitution and have no duty to the American public. So for the Department of Interior to put 90 of our national parks wildlife resources up for giving to tribal governments, these private governments, that substantially limits the availability and access of all the rest of the American public. And so I have a problem with that. I have a serious problem with that. The Bison Range was one of the first national treasures acquired. It was carved out of land that was once the Flathead Reservation. It was taken by eminent domain, and the tribe was paid for the land, actually twice paid for the land. And the American public contributed funds to the American Bison Society to purchase the bison and create the National Bison Range for everyone back in 1908. More recently, in 2016, just last year, President Obama signed the Bison Legacy Act and created the bison as the national mammal. So this is the long history and recent history of a treasure of the American public. And the plan is to literally give the land back to this tribe and give them the bison that were acquired by everybody else and just walk away from it. I have no U.S. or state or Fish and Wildlife or BLM, no federal responsibility whatsoever. It just goes back to the tribe free, though they were paid for the land twice and never paid for the bison. As a little side note, this tribe has been after the Bison Range for at least a decade, probably longer, and was given a management contract to manage. They weren't given the Bison Range, but they were given a year's contract to manage the Bison Range, called an annual funding agreement, in which they botched it so badly the funding agreement had to be pulled because they were mismanaging the bison.
How do you mess up managing a bison range?
Well, you got to know the difference between a cow and a bison. A bison is a very wild, aggressive animal, and it requires extremely special expertise to care for it, to keep it safe from, you know, keep it safe in its environment and keep it safe from the American public. It's really quite an animal, quite an animal, and it has high speed. It can run as fast as a horse, and it's huge, and it has a kind of a mean instinct. So you better know what you're doing. It's not like you're going out and roping a cow. And they just botched it, so they lost that funding agreement. And a couple of years later, they gave the tribe another chance to manage the bison range, and again, the tribe messed it up. What the tribe did was immediately fire all the folks that worked for the Fish and Wildlife that had the expertise and were managing the bison, but they fired them and hired in tribal employees only that didn't have the expertise. So since they failed in managing it twice, what they're doing now is saying, oh, well, then we'll just give it to you. And that's, you know, one of the most historic national treasures in the country. It's a big, beautiful bison range and massive. It's wonderful. It's got a couple of roads you can drive through and see the bison safely. It's just a majestic treasure that belongs to the entire American public. It should not be just handed over to a small tribal government.
So just out of curiosity, could they decide the public isn't allowed to be on the land? I mean, what kind of latitude is there in this agreement?
If they own the land and they own the bison, they call the shots. They can determine who can come in, who can't come in. They can determine, well, it's one price for you and it's another price for somebody else. They can do it. If they own the whole National Bison Range, they make all the decisions.
So it isn't like, when BLM manages public land or, Forest Service or anything like that. It isn't that type of an agreement. They're managing it, but we all still have access to it. It's literally private property now.
It really becomes under the 100% control of the tribe. And then the tribe can determine who's going to work there and who can access it and when, if at all. It's just something that is one of the 90 wildlife and refuges and parks around the country that is beginning to get handed off. And it's really, really troublesome to me. We have enough problems with the BLM, which provides access to all Americans regardless of, you know, your ethnicity or whatever.
Right.
We have enough trouble with the federal government managing some of these places and limiting access to public lands. But to hand them over to a private government that has no duty to the American public, and that was paid for the land twice, and that has is lacking the expertise in managing the bison, is just really an ugly solution. It's just something that troubles me. So the reason I want to mention this is because there is a, they call it a Comprehensive Conservation Plan, a CCP, that the Fish and Wildlife is preparing. And they're listing three alternatives. The preferred alternative is the one I'm just speaking of, just giving it over the top. Another alternative is that they continue manage, that the Fish and Wildlife continues managing it as it has for decades. And then a third one is the, another management, another annual funding agreement to give the tribe a third shot at just managing it but not owning it. So of those three, the reasonable one is that it stays under the Fish and Wildlife Services and is managed consistently as it has been and is available to the entire American public. Another problem with the tribal government owning the bison range is that they have sovereign immunity, of course. And so if somebody's should harm or injury happen, you're out of luck. You can't sue them.
If you did have access to the land, you and you were on there doing hiking or whatever, and something happened.
Let's say you're in a car and you're traveling the little roads through the bison range and looking at the bison, and there's one nearby that rams your car or hurts somebody. With their tribal sovereign immunity, you're just toast. There's nothing you can do.
Interesting. And if it's run by a federal agency, you do have some recourse?
There's a claim process to follow, and there's remedies.
I did not know that. We need to take a really quick break, and then we're going to come back with our guest, Elaine Willman, who really didn't tell you much about herself, so we'll do that when we come back.
Oh, okay.
We kind of glossed over that part. She has written two books. One is called Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. Second one is called Slumbering Thunder, A Primer for Combating the Spread of Federal Indian Policy and Tribalism Overwhelming America. So it's a kind of a topic that isn't covered a whole lot, and something that's a little bit confusing, and it's kind of good to get the information out there. So we're going to chat with Elaine for the rest of the program today. We hope you enjoy it. You are listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Body, then they go. What shall we do about them? What do they want? What do they want? If I had my way, I'd travel off to Buffalo, sit by the lake and watch the world go by. Ladies in the sun, listen to the rain.
Who knew? Buffalo songs. Are we going to get a lot of Buffalo songs? Are there many?
There are a lot of Buffalo Springfield songs, but there are not a great deal of songs actually about the buffalo or the bison.
Well, that seems wrong. What's the difference between buffalo and bison? Are they different?
It's just two different names for the same mammal.
Yeah, okay. All right, so I don't feel so... I don't know. I'm always getting snaked by seeing things that seem easy, and it turns out, oh no, there's a whole big thing.
Big
it's
difference.
Way more complicated than you could figure out. So, hey, we figured out how to fix the chat room. Turns out the link is different. So, if you are going to the We the People page, let's try to say that twice fast. Don't even go for three times, just twice is enough. You will have to refresh your page and try the link again, or you can go to kcnr1460.com and follow the link. It says live, and one of the choices there is to listen to the program live, obviously, or join the chat room. So
yeah,
it appears to be kind of working. It's different. It's different, you know. It'll probably ultimately be better, but it's different. So, you know, we're all everybody's bugged. It seems harder. All right. Back to Elaine. So Elaine's been a busy bee. Tell them a little bit about your background, Elaine, because it's interesting and it is important to know.
I forgot that part, and I thank you for that.
It's okay. We shot right to the buffalo.
I know. I am of strong Cherokee ancestry. My mother and grandmother were both enrolled, but I am not enrolled. And my husband was of Shoshone ancestry from Wyoming and a descendant of Sacagawea's adopted son, Basil. I've grown up with a lifetime affection for Native American history and culture, and as has my husband. And I've lived on three different Indian reservations for the past 25 years. The Yakima for 16 years, the Oneida Reservation in Wisconsin for 8 years, and now I'm out here on the Flathead for the last couple of years. And that's on purpose. Part of it is my affection for the Native American culture, and part of it is my professional career. The way I earned a living was I worked as community development director or assistant city manager for municipalities, towns and cities located on these reservations. The reservations were all opened up over 100 years ago with the Dawes Act, and with the Allotment Act, and with the Homestead Act. They all opened up, so most of the reservations are co-located within counties and towns. In fact, one-third of the counties in this country are co-located on Indian reservations, but the American public really doesn't snap to that, and the tribal voices don't mention it. But it's a big deal. Most of the reservations are predominantly non-Indian. There's big towns and counties and cities on all of them, but you just don't hear much about it. So what is an ongoing issue, not with all tribal governments, some do very good, is the peaceful coexistence of tribal governing and municipal and county governing within the boundaries of these reservations. Peaceful coexistence. Some tribal governments do a really good job, and they're very collaborative with their towns and counties. Others are just adamantly goal-oriented to take those counties and towns down and to grab land and take it off the tax base and to just drive the settlers out. So there are some really aggressive tribes that are causing quite a lot of havoc across the country, but not all of them. So the other thing that's going on is the power of these tribal governments, at least since 1988 when the casino money started rolling in, they've been very good at purchasing elected officials, which I call coin-operated elected officials, and they've been getting quite a largesse from the federal government. So my research and my voice is about government policies and government decision-making, which is very separate from the culture. We could be speaking of Irish governments located in a third of the counties across the country or some other ethnicity. It's about government decision-making. And the federal government seems to be hell-bent in handing over America's national parks and resources to these private tribal governments. Last year in Congress, there were a half a dozen, and fortunately we were able to beat them back for now, there were half a dozen bills in the House and the Senate to allow tribal governments to take over the management of our national forests as well. And again, we're speaking of 1% of America's population. Only 1% of America's population are enrolled tribal members. But their leadership is so well-funded and so politically influential, and if you say no, you're a racist, that they are really, really expanding tribal governing authority over our public resources and natural resources and treasures. And in my view, it's absolutely wrong. It's a disservice to all of the taxpayers that fund these and they enjoy these resources and their vacations and such. It's just wrong. And so I talk about it, you know. that's part of the issue. And the other part of the issue is that with some tribes, the treatment of their tribal members is really horrific. They don't have, their tribal constitutions do not recognize the U.S. Constitution. The tribal members don't have the Bill of Rights. They have an Indian Civil Rights Act that is toothless. There's no enforcement. There's no remedy for a tribal member, but Congress gave them the Indian Civil Rights Act as a feel-good piece of paper that does not help the tribal members. And so they have to be quiet. They can't speak up. There's pretty serious consequences if they disagree with their tribal leadership. So those are kind of the things that I have focused on for 25 years. How can I help the tribal families? And how can I focus and educate about government decision-making at the federal and state levels that are affecting all of us tribal families and the rest of us, too, on the reservation?
So are you saying that if you live on the reservation, the rights granted to you with the Constitution don't apply?
If you're a tribal member and you're an enrolled member of that tribe, the Bill of Rights and the rights under the Constitution do not apply to you as an enrolled tribal member.
You're governed by their law, not the Constitution.
Yeah. Okay. If you're an enrolled tribal member, you're governed by the tribal law as an enrolled tribal member on the reservation. Yeah. Now, the term that is used that helps folks understand is we call the reservations checkerboarded. Since they were opened up for settling and all the lands were allotted out to individual Indians, and the reservations were totally transformed over 100 years ago. They installed counties, towns, and whatnot. We have checkerboarded land. By that I mean you may have one property owner who's a non-tribal property owner who is governed by a city and a county, and right next door you have an Indian trust parcel who is governed by a tribal government. It makes it difficult for planning, for planners in counties and towns, and I imagine tribal planners as well. It makes it difficult to peacefully coexist and have compatible land uses with two separate governments within the same boundary. So those are the kinds of difficulties that I've had to work with as a public employee for cities on reservations. And those are the complications of co-located, coexisting governments that have very different agendas and serve very different populations. So that's kind of the big picture of what the ongoing struggle is. And it's not a struggle on all reservations. There are tribes that are great neighbors. There are a few. But there are, unfortunately, more that are not great neighbors and that have tied into a larger agenda who really promote and support the United Nations Indigenous Movement, who want to take back all their Aboriginal lands, and who are actively working with the big greenies in the United Nations and the liberals in our federal government to unsettle the West, literally unsettle the West. And so that's where the peaceful coexistence gets increasingly problematic right now.
Sure, because some of the tribes are really good resource, not just resource managers, but resource users. I mean, they wind up being, you know, they're logging. They, I know there's a whole group in Oklahoma that are meat packers. I mean, there are a lot of tribes that are really industrious and you know, you'd like them. It's funny, you know, looking at what's happening in California. I mean, we'd like folks like that taking over some of our public land, because they could actually thin the trees and do some of that stuff that we can't do, because every time the Forest Service tries, they get sued or, you know, they're afraid of being sued, so they just don't do it.
Yeah. There's some wonderful expertise within tribal governments and wonderful land management.
But it isn't always.
You know, there's some very, very good things within the tribal resources. There's no question about that. I guess it's sort of like anything else. You know, we have state agencies across the country that are really good at what they do, and we have some that just suck. You know what I mean? So it's just
we've managed to have a lot of those here. We pride ourselves on being at the epicenter of the sucking, actually.
Well, yeah, I think Oroville Dam's a good example.
Yeah,
of
we just call it California, but it's really just sort of defaulting to the sucking right now.
I know. So
we got to take another quick break, Elaine. We'll be right back.
Okay.
That always degenerates into government bashing, doesn't it? But it's so cathartic, you know.
You can't help yourself.
No, I can't. Well, you deal with it enough, and after a while, you start looking around, going, "What the heck?" Oh, this sounds like a fun little song. You're listening to We the People.
Oh, give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer and the antelope play. Where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. Home, home on the range, where the deer and the antelope play. Where seldom heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day.
I was waiting for the punchline there. And we're back. So, Elaine, explain the difference between trust land and reservation land and all that. We sort of blew by that, but it's kind of confusing.
Indian trust land is land that is owned by the United States in title for the beneficial use and occupancy of the tribe. The title is that the land is owned by the United States, and the tribe has beneficial use and occupancy and governing authority over those lands, those parcels. That's part of the checkerboarding. There's Indian trust land all over the reservations.
So how does it become trust land?
Some of it was reinstated as trust land in 1934 under the Indian Reorganization Act, but all of it is increasing every year, because especially since the gaming money, because the tribes can buy private properties on the open market, and then they pursue an application to the Department of Interior to have the land taken into trust and taken off the tax rolls and taken off of jurisdiction of the states and counties. And so that's how they grow the Indian trust land base. They can buy any property they want from any willing seller, and they pay top dollar. And then they have the land taken into federal trust by the United States, and it's removed from the state and county tax base, and it's removed from state and county and local jurisdiction. So it's their land, but it's owned by the United States. The rest of the lands are regular lands, like where all of us live, private property under the jurisdiction of the local town or city or county or state, tax-paying properties, and they're the other part of the checkerboard. So you have the two kinds of parcels or properties within Indian reservations.
And so the trust land, a tribe could live on that land? They could build houses?
Oh, sure. They have full control of it.
Okay. What's the benefit between, whether you're a tribe or not a tribe, why do we have two types of land? Why do we have reservation land and why do we have trust land?
That's a very big question, but one of the things that happened was a shift in congressional positions that created this, what I call, monster, because it's a real monster for all parties. It really is.
Because my understanding is, like, California, can California make trust land? Don't they do that for the casinos?
Yes, the casinos have to be on land held in title by the United States.
But it's not always done by the federal government, though. It can be done by the state?
No, it's federal trust land.
Okay.
It has to
be. Maybe it's just the gaming contract that can be done by the state?
Yeah, the folks that fund those casinos, and basically that's the rest of the gaming industry, like Stations Casino and MGM and some Malaysian folks, they'll buy a big prime property with the plan of building a casino, and they'll pursue that property. They'll put an application into the Bureau of Indian Affairs and say, we propose to build a casino on this land. We want it taken into federal trust. And so as soon as the land is in federal trust, the casino can go up.
So that's how the casinos seem to pop up just about anywhere. They don't have to be on a reservation. They just have to be have to be trust land, so they can go out and buy land anywhere they want.
Yep, there's basically a lot of off reservation casinos now.
Yeah, just give it give the land to the federal government, and now you got yourself casino land.
It was originally the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was originally intended for an economic tool for tribes to have casinos on within the boundaries of their reservations, but they put the little loopholes in there where they can put them anywhere as long as the land is in federal trust.
So is the federal trust land, does that fall under the same rules as reservation land as far as your rights if you're on that property?
It falls under the 100% jurisdiction of the tribe. So if you're a visiting casino customer and you get injured in the parking lot or your car is vandalized or you get food poisoning or something, they have sovereign immunity. You're out of luck.
So the Indian Trust land is sovereign land as well.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. There's no state or county authority or responsibilities. It's 100% land managed and owned, or managed on behalf of the tribe.
But it's interesting that it's owned by the federal government, and yet you don't have your constitutional rights on it. That's bizarre.
No. Yeah, it is, but that's the way it is, and that's part of this big shift that occurred early on in the 1870s. The reservations, that's what they called the assimilation period, where the Congress and a lot of bleeding heart American citizens truly felt that tribal members should be able to be full citizens like everybody else and should be able to own property and vote, and they wanted the reservation systems taken down. That's what motivated the Dawes Act, to give individual Indians a piece of land that included water and the right to vote. And when that Indian allotment, Latee, got his land, he became a citizen of that state. He could own property, he could vote, and he was no longer a member of his tribe. So this was going on in the 1870s and early 1900s, and it was almost done. All American Indians were made full citizens in 1924, whether they owned land or not. All American citizens in the Snyder Act, all American Indians, 1924 became citizens. Congress was heading for full, equal opportunity, equal rights for Indians. And then 10 years later, an avowed communist by the name of John Collier managed to become the Commissioner of Indian Affairs and put through the Indian Reorganization Act. And his message was, hey, this assimilation isn't working. They're better with their living apart from the rest of the society and living and having their own culture and their own reservations. And so from 1934 forward, it started reversing. And so all those reservations that were opened up and towns and counties formed on them, suddenly the whole thing started reversing, and that's where we have the checkerboarded lands and the dual governing systems, and which worked out okay for many, many years. People managed to work together, tribal governments and towns and counties. There was a pretty good rapport because there was a real cultural diversity on the reservations, and there's a very good live and let live. Then the gaming came in 88, and all of a sudden the big money and the big power and some of the rowdier tribes have become extremely abusive of their neighbors. Not, as I said, not all. Especially the tribes that aren't gaming. They get along very well with their neighbors, but the gaming tribes with the big money are really becoming bullies, and they're getting a lot of help from the federal government now through those coin-operated elections.
Right.
Well,
another thing that I don't think a lot of people realize is that if you're on the Indian rolls on a reservation, you don't pay any sales tax if you live on the reservation. Now, that doesn't hold true if you're not on the Indian rolls and you live on the reservation. Is that right?
Well, I lived on the Yakima Reservation for 16 years, and let me give that as an example, because that reservation is almost 80% Hispanic, and 10% Anglo and 10% Indian. And so my husband and I would go into the Safeway store in Toppenish, Washington for our groceries. We might be the only Anglos in the building. And we would get in line to pay for our groceries. And if we were behind a tribal member in the same Safeway store, the tribal member would not have to pay sales tax on the reservation. But right. We would. Everybody else does.
Right.
Is there a special card, or how do they know?
They have their enrollment cards, or they, you know, a lot of folks are very obviously Indian. They just say no tax, and they don't have to pay sales tax, but the other customers do, the non-Indian customers do. And I think that that's the way it is pretty much on most reservations.
I know that's the way it is here in our town.
Yeah,
any big-ticket items, a car, a tractor, something like that, it's delivered to the reservation, there's no sales tax.
Right, and that was the big deal. And also, the Yakima is the city of Yakima, Washington, is not on the Indian reservation. So the tribal members would go into the car dealerships in the city of Yakima, and they would pick out a car, and they'd say, I want to buy this car. And they'd have the dealership drive it to their home on the reservation to avoid the sales tax.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, it seems a little bit unfair, because it doesn't really cut both directions.
Well, it can get a lot unfair, because the counties and towns have to provide the fire services.
That's right.
The Yakima County Sheriffs have to provide full protection to all the lands within the county. Yakima Fire Protection District. So when a fire would occur on a tribal property, the Yakima Fire Protection would respond and put it out and whatnot, but they receive no money from the tribal government for the fire services.
But that's a that's not mandatory. Isn't that an agreement they have?
But some tribes do.
Mandatory.
Oh, they do. Really? They absolutely have to provide those services.
They have to respond to every property in the county if there's a call for fire service. It's mandatory, but the tribe doesn't reimburse the county for its fire protection.
Wow.
But, and police, I know sometimes they have their own law enforcement on tribal property if it's kind of a big place.
And for the most part, that works pretty well. There's tribal police and municipal police and county sheriffs and state highway. And on the ground, the law enforcement officers on the ground and in the vehicles and responding to calls work pretty much very well together. There's a camaraderie among the multiple forces on the ground. Where the confusion can come in is that a call for maybe there's a crime being committed on somewhere out on the reservation, and you have two or three different responders, and the first thing they have to determine is this state land, is this county land, is this tribal land, to see who takes the lead in law enforcement.
Right.
And so it has its complications, but for the most part, the tribal law enforcement folks and the other law enforcement folks work really well. Where it gets ugly is at the political level of tribal leaders who push for their tribal officers to be able to write a ticket to a non-tribal member into a tribal court or something like that. The officers, a county sheriff will cite a non-tribal person into a county court. A tribal or the county sheriff will cite a tribal member into his tribal court. So there's a lot of complications.
Are we talking like speeding tickets and stuff?
Like speeding tickets and, you know,
really?
And things of that nature, yes.
So
it has to be cited in the proper court.
So
because
have to
a
be
non-tribal
a,
person it, has no rights in a tribal court.
Yeah, right.
They don't have any due process, so they have to be cited into the court of their government.
Are we talking on big reservations? Because around here we don't really have, I guess I'm just thinking, you know, you're always looking at, mentally looking through your own town. And
it can be big or small.
Really? And they all have a tribal court, huh?
Most of them do. Even the very small reservations all along the Washington coast, which is highly urbanized, and most of those little reservations, they still have their tribal courts, and their members get cited into the tribal court, and the non-members get cited into municipal or county courts.
So if I go to a casino, and I'm walking back out to my car, and I see somebody breaking into my car, and I want to press charges, if they're not a tribal member, does that person get tried in a tribal court because they're on the reservation, or do they go to the county?
You know, I'm not an attorney, but I believe if
you
the person
damaging
your car
right?
is a non-tribal person, I think you can press charges in a municipal or county court. If you know the individual is not a tribal member,
right.
I think you can cite the individual into a municipal or county court. I'm not.
But if they're a tribal member, then the tribal court tries them?
But you can't hold the casino managers or the tribe responsible for any harm that happens to you by either, by a tribal or not. You can't hold the casino. They have sovereign immunity.
Interesting.
But if you happen to know the individual, you catch them red-handed, you can have them arrested if it's a non-tribal person.
Hmm. Very tricky. We need to take a really quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about more tricky stuff that we don't...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the tricky stuff.
Elaine's not an attorney, but she stayed at a Holiday Inn Express, so she's going to be our attorney for today.
That's right. She played one on TV.
We'll be right back.
I'm an Indian outlaw, half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa. She's a one of a kind. All my friends call me Bear Claw. The village chicken is my pawpaw. He gets his orders from my mama. She makes him walk the line. You can find me in my wigwam. I'll be beating on my tom-tom. Pull out the pipe and smoke you some. And pass it around. Cause I'm an Indian outlaw, half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa. She's a one of a kind.
The whole Cherokee Nation put us on this reservation, took away our ways of life, the tomahawk and the bow and knife. Our native tongue and taught their English to our young. And all the beads we made by hand are nowadays made in Japan. Cherokee people, Cherokee tribe, so proud to live, so proud to die.
There you go, Elaine. It's your song for all your relatives.
I heard it. I love it.
That's a great song.
Yeah. I would like to wrap up on the Bison Range.
Yes,
and move on to
you're reading my mind.
But I wanted to mention one thing.
Okay.
The public can comment on whether you support or oppose the National Bison Range being given to a small private government, like a tribal government. And you can do that by sending an email to a very nice lady. Her name is Toni Griffin, and her email address is TONI_Griffin, GRIFFIN, at SWS.gov. TONI_Griffin at SWS.gov. I have a pup here, I'm sorry. The deadline for the comments was February 17th, so we're a day or two past that. But Tony told me that they accept comments after the deadline. So if there are listeners who believe that our national parks and our national wildlife refuges and the National Bison Range should stay in the hands of federal or state management, it would be really helpful if some of your readers would shoot Tony an email very quickly and say, we oppose this, because quantity counts on these comments. And she's accepting comments after the deadline.
Absolutely.
Oh, great.
So if you happen to be driving or you're doing something else and you didn't have a chance to write all that down, just go to the page at wethepeopleradio.us And I headed that segment from Elaine that says National Bison Range needs your comments. And Tony Griffin at fishandwildlifeservice.gov, her information is there.
FWS.gov. Yeah. So the second piece I wanted to talk about, and this is an early heads up. I spotted it, and it shocked me that it was even in the Federal Register. I got this stupid little, I'm dog sitting.
It's quite a wolf you got there.
Arthur's out barking in the car, I'm sure.
He's a little border collie pup, and he wants to play with our older dog, and the older dog's not having it.
We know that story.
I was going to say, we were having that in the car, too.
So the other is a notice that came out in the Federal Register, I think it was February 8th, and it's called Traders with Indians. And that caught my eye. I thought, what do you mean traders with Indians? That's, you know, we're going back a long, over a century. And it's an advance notice to the proposed rulemaking. Trigger words there are proposed rulemaking. It's an advance notice where they're setting up 6 consultation meetings with tribes across the country to update the Traders with Indians regulations. Well, the Traders with Indians regulations, it started in 1876, and that's when most of the Western states weren't even states. We had a lot of territories, and that's a time period where there were truly scoundrel folks that were abusive when trading with Indians, and they needed some control and enforcement. So they put in the Traders with Indians regulation that required any person doing any form of commerce with an Indian tribe to be approved and licensed under the sole authority of the BIA commissioner. And that gave the commissioner enforcement to pick up the guys that were abusing their trades with Indians. That was 1876. So all of a sudden we're in 2017, and we want to upgrade Traders with Indians. And they're setting up these consultation meetings across the country, from Florida to Washington State. The problem goes back to our checkerboarded reservations, massive businesses, non-tribal businesses in towns and counties across Indian country that have no responsibility or accountability. The tribes have no authority over the non-tribal businesses or anything. And there's an effort. It is spawned by, I think, 2 people. One is the current chair of the National Congress of American Indians, a fellow named Brian Clattersby. He's also the chair of a small little tribe. I think they have 491 members up in western Washington, the Swinomish tribe. And so Brian Clattersby, as his chair, while he's in the power seat of the National Congress of Indians, he's bringing this forward. The first consultation meeting happens to be on his reservation. The other one is, I believe, John McCoy, who's the top dog, or one of the top dogs, at the Tulalip tribe, another small tribe in western Washington.
Elaine, we'll have to roll this over into the next hour, but I wanted people to know that clip from the Federal Register is actually on the page for today. So
yeah, let's pick up this story, because this is interesting.
Yes, actually, and during the news break, you could actually go read it. You got like 5 minutes, and you already know the news. It's just the same stuff. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.